Hello, it's great to have you with me. I'm Kim Clyden, former ABC radio presenter and children's book author, creating a community of people who care about children. How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? And they say it takes a village. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. We're surrounded, though, by people who can support us, your family, friends, and professionals, who all play an influential role in shaping our children. Imagine if your parents, teachers, relatives, or carers told you another story. Your life story would be completely different. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. In the previous episode, Jade Miles talked about how regenerating landscapes, reconnecting people with their food and the land from which it grows, cultivates strong communities of change, something she feels is crucial for our holistic health and future. Today, there's much more information about the relationship between the gut and nutrition and how it affects the brain and our nervous system. Could that account for the diversity of neural development? Our mind and body function together. So it makes sense that if any system is not functioning at an optimum level, there will be an effect on the others. There's been a shift towards considering individual brain function when interacting with children and adults. Parenting in the 60s and 70s focused on disciplining unruly behaviours. By the 80s, many were questioning why the behavioural parenting style wasn't necessarily achieving results with all children. Neuroscience research in the 90s delivered some answers. My guest today, occupational therapist Christian Vincenter, serves neurodiverse families as a neurodivergent coach, specialising in autism and ADHD. Through his work with children in the 90s, he identified that he also had traits of ADHD and had been raised in a neurodiverse home. Christian, it's lovely to have you on the program. Why did you originally choose to work in this field?
For many different reasons. It feels right. And it's been a very comfortable space for me for decades. You know, I came into the field not really knowing about my own neurodivergence. And so right after high school, I signed up for a business major in college. And halfway through the year, I realized I was completely bored out of my mind. Having some kind of flash forward and thinking, oh my gosh, if I keep going this way, someday I'll be 40 and I'll have a midlife crisis because I'll be hating my life. So I thought, well, what do I want to do? And a very imperfect message came in, but came in very loud and clear. It was, I want to help people. Some kind of health-related mental health profession. And I didn't know, I was 18 at the time. And this was in the 70s. So there was no, you know, of course, no internet. So doing any kind of research was a little tougher. You know, you had to go to a library or go to a bookstore and look at career books and find what you could. Long story short, I settled on the profession of occupational therapy. It just sounded good for different reasons. And I ended the business major, started occupational therapy, became an occupational therapist, greatest decision I've ever made. And I started working with kids who were, at the time, they weren't called neurodivergent because the word wasn't really in existence. I don't think it came up until the 90s or so. And then I would get a lot of positive feedback from the kids. And then the parents would give me feedback like, how do you know what my kid need? I mean, I just saw you, they were about to melt down and I would have done something completely different than what you did. And every time it results into a meltdown or a worsening of the situation, and somehow you just did something totally different. And I felt like you weren't doing enough, but then my kid calmed down. So little by little, I started reflecting. And the next realization, the dots that I connected was, well, a lot of those kids were labeled as quirky, as having behaviors that didn't always make sense to people, to parents, to educators, to family, friends. And I thought, my dad is very quirky. You know, my dad has a lot of those sensory sensitivities. So my dad was very kind and smart and responsible and dedicated to our family, but he had a lot of, he was absolutely neurodivergent. And I don't know exactly what it was, but he was definitely a highly sensitive person, very rigid for certain things. You know, he could space out and daydream for a long time. So I started looking at that and thinking, well, I think maybe that because I learned so much of how to be around my dad, someone anticipating what he needs to be okay, because some, you know, some of his feedback was, he was, for example, very sound sensitive. So as soon as my sister and I would play just like kids play, he would, you know, he wasn't mean about it, but he would say, hey, that's too much noise. Or we would go, for a day trip somewhere for the day on the weekend. And if it was too windy or too hot, he would say, oh, let's just go home. It's too windy. That's not fun. To the point where he just could not handle it anymore. Or there were too many transitions or too many people. So I realized that I had learned a great deal about kind of like tuning into other people's well-being and people's emotional shift without necessarily having a verbal signal about it. And my mom was, she's a whole other mystery, but she had a lot of anxiety and also very kind, very loving. But I learned to really tune into other people around me. You know, for me, it was never about behavioral compliance. It was never about, I told you to do this, you have to do it or you'll be punished. And even though that mindset was still fairly strong, my approach was always about, well, how can I create a space to, how can I create engagement? How can I have this child connect with me and play? Because somehow I intuitively got that we couldn't have any progress unless the child was engaged. I could not force progress into someone. There was a very strong element of understanding brain functioning and how the brain operates and how those different parts of the brain can create regulation, dysregulation, you know, and how we can become so overwhelmed that we can no longer process information. And it's not a matter of laziness. It's not a matter of not doing what we should. It's a matter of just, we just can't. The nervous system is dysregulated. But in the 90s, there were a lot of, it was kind of like this explosion of neuroscience information. You know, brain mapping technology was improving. I was talking a lot more about ADHD and neurodivergence in all sorts of ways. And I had a lot of adults, you know, adult connections, acknowledging their own neurodivergence and saying, oh yeah, I have ADHD or I'm autistic. And then people started asking me, do you have ADHD yourself? I'm pretty sure I do. I took this online test. I did more research. I found a private psychiatrist who specialized in adults with ADHD. And to say, yeah, you definitely have ADHD. So there was no longer a stigma for me at that point, which was good. I'm grateful for that. But it really kind of like started a whole other layer of self-awareness, self-discovery, and better understanding. And I'm still, you know, a few years past the diagnosis, I'm still uncovering layers of masking. It's like, oh, that's what I'm doing. That's what, you know, so it's fascinating to me.
Recently, I learnt about the brain and its connection to the nervous system through Eileen Devine, who specialises in brain-first parenting and coaches parents of children with neurobehavioural differences. You mentioned before that you've created this way to work with children. What model have you been able to utilise effectively and consistently?
You know, when I describe my approach, I use a couple of different terms. So the first term that I use is neuroaffirming, because it really takes into consideration that all that we do when trying to understand a child's neurodivergence, a child's behaviors, a child's desire to do things that may seem odd to maybe to others, or is very often related to how the nervous system is wired. And neuroaffirming is very important because it really moves away from looking at the child as not doing the right thing because they're lazy or because they're bad or because they just don't want to, or which is of course not, or if they don't want to, it's because their nervous system is getting overwhelmed and not able to engage. So I also talk about being relationship based, because when kids develop, they don't develop in a vacuum. They develop within the context of relationships or the relationships around them. And it's, you know, of course, it's the primary relationships with their caregiver, their parents, or the, you know, they're raised by someone else, their grandparents or whoever. And then, you know, it's the relationship with other people in their lives, maybe their teachers, their friends. And so a lot gets explored through those relationships. And that's what, you know, that's how we learn a lot about boundaries, about what's okay, about what's not okay, about verbal, nonverbal communication, about, you know, all of that is based on the relationship. So in the context of my work, I'm always looking at how can I use the parent-child relationship to create change in the family. And so I approach it also as a family-based practice, because most often parents are being told, well, take your child there to that place and then they'll take care of them and then things will improve. And that may be the case for certain skills. You know, I see wonderful speech therapists. I see wonderful occupational therapists and vision therapists and tutors and whatever the case is. But it's too often the model of doing something with the child and not including the parents. And that presents a lot of, and that, you know, I've used that model for a long time. And that's one of the reasons why I left occupational therapy eventually to transition into parent coaching, because I was working about 80% of the time with kids and about 20% of the time with parents, having, you know, a consultation once in a while, once a month, and telling them, okay, let's review what's been happening during the session. So here's what would help at home. Parents always said yes, but realistically, you know, when I started asking the parents, how is this working for you? And they would look at me and say, what do you mean? I'm here for my kid. I'm like, no, but how is this working for the whole family? And then eventually, once I kept asking, you know, I had parents who fell apart crying because they say, I'm overwhelmed. You know, every single day we have to take, you know, the siblings to the other siblings' therapy sessions. And there, so we have some, you know, some of our kids are melting down because they're bored in the car or they're bored at the therapy sessions, you know, in the waiting rooms, and they're bored and it's just nonstop. And then they still were not given really tools that worked to improve things at home. So I thought, well, nobody's really working with the parents. This is what I need to do. And so through that, you know, I talk a lot about the importance of regulation and understanding the whole regulation framework. So I've developed a framework over the years. I created a guide on regulation about 6 months ago, and I'm offering it for free to parents raising a child with ADHD or autism. And it talks a lot about regulation, that what is regulation, why is it so important in the context of ADHD and autism, because every single person, child or adult, that I have worked with who has ADHD and autism struggles with regulation. Any kind of research, you know, brain research on ADHD and autism, it's there. But what often the piece that's missing is, even though more and more people are familiar with the term regulation, they don't really understand how it affects them, or they don't really understand how much it impacts them and what to do about it.
From all of that experience with children, how have you been able to develop tools for parents that they can then apply at home to make situations better for all ages?
There's a lot of phrase that I've used that I use a lot. Your child is not giving you a hard time. They are having a hard time. So that phrase resonates with a lot of parents, because what it does is that it creates a bit of an opening. It creates a bit of space to look at, oh, why is my child having a hard time? What are they having a hard time with? How can I support them if they're having a hard time? Because every parent wants to support their child. And obviously every family is different and every child is different. But starting from that place of, let's look at what your child needs in that moment. Often when I start working on one-on-one coaching with parents, we start with a situation that tends to come up very often in family's life. So it could be getting ready for school in the morning, it could be going to bed at night, it could be getting ready for homework, it could be, you know, and any of those routine type things that happen on a regular basis. When the parents say, you know, it's just not sustainable. I mean, it's taking us, you know, 4 hours to do homework. So let's look at why it's happening. Depending on where the parents are in the journey in terms of understanding, and sometimes I do a combination of sharing information that's a little more brain-based, that may be a little difficult to find on their own. They could find it, but they wouldn't necessarily know where to look or how to apply it. So I share some information, and then we'll tackle a specific situation and really look at, you know, what are the contributing factors? Often as the parents, why do you think your kid is melting down? Well, why do you think your kid is refusing to try something new? And sometimes they realize that they've never thought of that. That they thought they were so focused on supporting their child because they felt bad that their child could not participate at a higher level, that often creates anxiety for parents. And then they double down and say, you need to do this because something bad is going to happen if you don't do this. So you're not going to develop, you're not going to learn, you're not going to. And so once you give parents permission to say, well, let's look at what your kid needs right now. Well, they're very sound sensitive. So probably the sound, the noise in that birthday party is what triggered them. Okay. All right. So does your child know that? I don't know. Okay. So we're going to have to educate them one way or another because they may have sound sensitivities for the rest of their lives. And how independent about it? How are they going to feel good about it? We don't want them to mask and say, oh, no, I'm fine. And then go into a migraine at 2 p.m. because they're completely overstimulated and dysregulated. So it's a combination of educating and really tuning into what their child needs and then what makes sense for the parents. Because, you know, some parents may tell me, it's really important for us that at dinner time, we're all together, we all sit down around the table. Okay, then that's what we work with. And for other families, that is not a priority at all. So I really work with the family, every family culture, family personality, the preferences of the family, of the child, and really trying to look at what's going on with the child and how does that land with the parents? Because often the part that's often talked about is the parents' dysregulation. And many of the parents I work with are also neurodivergent, diagnosed or not. So there's several really complicated dynamics in there because if they grew up as neurodivergent, they most likely grew up with a lot of negative feedback. And they most likely internalized a lot of shame and a lot of narrative along the lines of, I'm bad, I can't get anything right, I'm so disorganized. Then if you have a child who's, and if you were, you know, if you were corrected, overly corrected when you were growing up for those symptoms, and you were never validated, and you were then, you know, you grew up and you created the life that you could, the best you could, but you know you're going to get triggered. When your own child shows the same type of behaviors, you know you're going to get triggered because, you know, there's also, it's going to be different for every parent. But one possible dynamic is that suddenly you're, you know, it could be that, oh, well, you're anxious because you're afraid that your kid is going to be treated the way you were treated. So you tell them, don't do that. Or it's just a habit because you've internalized that the right way of being a kid is to do things a certain way and to, you know, do X, Y, Z is not being a good kid. So you're telling your kid, no, you can't do this.
And if you've got that dynamic of neurodivergence in generational iterations, then obviously it's going to be compounded.
So I do make space for that because at times the work that I do is actually more on the parent side to help the parents, you know, really learn new ways to self-regulate. When I can tell how triggered they are by one of the child's behavior, I ask them for permission to explore that. And then, you know, they start sharing about how it affects them physically, how it affects them mentally, emotionally, how they can't sleep at night or how it brings up their childhood. So having a chance to process it in a space that is completely safe, where there's zero judgment and, you know, that validates their emotions and the experience, we usually see pretty profound changes even within a few months.
I think I need to make an appointment. I'm just feeling like you just hit some triggers for me in that I don't sleep. I've been having a real lot of trouble lately. I'm not sure what's underpinning it, but, you know, that is a real issue for a lot of people who may not even recognize ADHD or autism is something for them. As you just pointed out, it's not something we grow out of. So what can employers do, or what do they need to know about neurodivergence in the workplace?
Oh, so I was just part of a mental health /HR conference a couple of weeks ago, and I was on the panel discussion, and the whole theme was how does neurodivergence fit in the workplace and what happens? And it, you know, it's really tricky because what's talked about in the workplace is accommodations. But what's tricky with accommodations is that you have to out yourself first. You have to say, hey, I have ADHD or I have autism, and this is hard for me, and can we do it somehow differently? Or, and that's really difficult because, you know, history is not in our favor. You know, history tells us that, well, if you speak up about this, you're probably going to be seen as not a very good employee. There might be retaliation. You might not be promoted. You might be let go. That's the reality. It absolutely depends on the environment, on the supervisor, on the kind of company. And, you know, ideally, for me, my ideal vision is that accommodation should not be based on diagnosis. Accommodation should be based on helping employees be their best and really finding out about the employees and asking them and say, what's draining your energy in your job? Okay, you took on this job because you're good at it. You're qualified for it. We hired you because you're qualified. Because for someone, it might be the constant interruptions of coworkers or supervisors coming to the office to say, hey, I just have a quick question about this. Or I just have a quick question about that. Well, for someone with ADHD or even autism, those interruptions are not just a 1 minute thing. It could take 10 minutes, 20 minutes for the person to refocus on what they were doing. They may lose their flow. It could be that, you know, someone is brilliant at facilitating meetings, but they're really terrible at taking notes. And they get distracted when taking notes and they can't, you know, they lose track of what's going on and then they can't focus on information. And so do we really want to provide training to that person? Do we really want to, you know, write them up and say, you need to do better? Or, you know, do we want to say, taking notes is not an essential function of your job. I mean, it's such a small part. So I'm pretty sure there's somebody on the team who loves taking notes, who's really good at taking notes.
All workplaces should work like that, though. I mean, even politics should focus on the people who are best fitted for the job. I've always wondered why we don't do enough profiling, personality profiling, skills profiling, when we actually choose someone to fill a role. It doesn't make any sense, Christian.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. And then, you know, once we help people be their best, their productivity goes, and it's really a win-win for everyone. Organizations don't realize how much they're shooting themselves in the foot for being rigid about how productivity is supposed to look like, or how you know, a good worker is supposed to look like. You know, again, accommodations, it's, and the underlying message is we need to be flexible. One size doesn't fit all. There are lots of people with ADHD who swear that using a standing desk is the best, helps them focus. And it's true for some of them. But, you know, standing desk for their house because they do better. I have ADHD. I can't use a standing desk. It just doesn't work for me at all. And you know, it would really make my ability to focus worse. So if you have an organization who say, oh, ADHD, okay, we've got a sheet of, you know, accommodations that we can give you. You'll get a standing desk by tomorrow. No, it's got to be completely individualized. The tragedy is that there are most likely a lot more people who are neurodivergent but who are not diagnosed than neurodivergent people who are diagnosed. So if you're not diagnosed, then it means you can't have an accommodation. But what if that standing desk is going to help you perform way better in your job? You know, as the CEO or whoever, you know, wouldn't you want your staff to feel like just empowered and more productive and say, I love this company, I love this place, they get me. My work is so much easier than if I had to work somewhere else.
It's funny, you've just described parenting in a household. The comparison to a CEO or manager of a company, it just fits perfectly. Like, we treat the workplace the same as we treat parenting in the home. Wow, that's the first time I've actually correlated those two things, which are completely different but exactly the same.
I'm glad you picked up on that, because that's one theme that came up during that conference talk I was mentioning earlier, and it was you know, there's so many parallels between parent leadership and work leadership and organization leadership. You know, I feel like a lot of our society, at least in the Western world, has been very much compliance based. You know, I'm sure there's other terms, official terms for it. You know, different schools of thought, but it's very much about you have to do things a certain way or you're no longer a good person. And I think, you know, we've seen that with hair, people's hair, workers' hair supposed to look like, or, you know, beards. I mean, there's still a lot of, you know, a lot of sectors where it's like, oh no, we need a clean look. What do you mean clean? Am I dirty? You tell me I'm dirty?
It's the same, like tattoos. It could go on and on and on. Yeah. I mean, even what we've seen in the White House, expecting Zelensky to wear a suit when, you know, he has this standard clothing that he has adopted as the leader of his own country. Oh, yes. Anyway, we could go on and on and on, but I'm really looking forward to revisiting some of this and breaking it down even further. Yeah. Christian, I'm sure you've got other things to do today, but thank you so much for devoting an hour of your time to me today. It's been a pleasure getting to know you, and I hope we can do it again.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a great conversation, and yeah, I'd be happy to explore any of the topics again. So thank you. Thank you so much.
Neurodivergent coach specializing in autism and ADHD, Christian Vincenter from San Diego, California. Want to know more? Well, you'll find all the links to Christian's socials and website in the show notes, where you'll also find links to my website, socials, and contact details. This podcast is recorded in Launchpad Studios thanks to Greater Wit Sunday Innovation, formerly Split Spaces.